The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris. Joining us in the studio, Russellinda Guillen, Executive Director of Community to Community and a powerful activist in many ways, and Michelle Stelovich, who is the President of the Northwest Washington Central Labor Council. And we have a lot of big labor-related issues that we're going to dig into, including H-2A guest workers and the Supreme Court case that could destroy unions once and for all. But we're going to lead with some breaking news. We just heard in the past hour that Representative Chris Litton from the 40th Legislative District is going to retire at the end of the year.
Yeah, it's a bit of a surprise. It's a fairly safe seat for Litton. I don't think that she would draw very serious competition in the 40th, so it's interesting that that's going to be thrown out. You know, she was the chair of the Finance Committee, which is very powerful. She'd introduced and passed a number of bills just in the last session and the one before. The only thing that I can think of that was a big priority for her that didn't pan out was a capital gains tax to offset the property tax increase that came from the 2017 session. So, yeah, if you know anyone in South Bellingham,
or
has
Skagit.
No representation.
Yeah.
Skagit has representation.
True. I do want to, this is unfair of me, but when I think about all of the stuff with public disclosure and the legislative motions to protect themselves, and then I saw that Representative Litton cited family issues, I hate to say it, but when I see a representative citing family issues, it's almost code these days because
we're all so cynical. Who wants to retire to spend time with their family? You know, nobody says that and means it. But, you know, I genuinely, you know, have to open my heart to the idea that there are people who enjoy spending time with their family and want to.
It is odd, too, because there have been so many legislative sessions where progressives have struggled so hard, and we didn't get everything we wanted this time. But, you know, the wind was in our sails. So for her to step down now is I mean, maybe she feels like she's leaving it in good hands. So we will see how that develops, and we'll be happy to jump up and rip like dogs into whoever runs for her spot. But that will be ahead. First, let's take a look. The legislative session of 2017 has ended, and Dave is going to give us a rundown on the big and the small and what's going on.
You know, the biggest news is, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago with Initiative 940. We talked with the chief of police about it, and what that was an effort to kind of change the way the state oversees policing in Washington. And, you know, because right now you have to prove if an officer kills someone in the line of duty, you would have to prove that they had malice in their heart when they committed that act in order for them to be prosecuted.
Which is impossible.
And, you know, the initiative gathered a bunch of signatures, was headed for the ballot, and at the last minute, right at the close of the session, the state legislature got together with police groups and the activists from De-Escalate Washington who were pushing the initiative and came up with a deal. They passed the initiative as session law and then passed modifications to it. So it preserves the getting rid of malice as a requirement for prosecuting a police officer. It tweaks the first aid requirement in the initiative. An officer had to make providing first aid on the scene their paramount duty, and that is an undefined term that we have a bad history with in this state. And in this case, it cleans that up, makes it a bit more reasonable. It changes the good faith exemption to simplify that for when a police officer injures or kills someone. So that's really kind of the bombshell at the end of the session. There is already a lawsuit threatened by Tim Iman, who alleges that the process was unconstitutional, and it may in fact have been unconstitutional, but we will find out as it works its way through the court.
It's interesting that you bring up the first aid aspect. I think those of us who are passionate about this issue are concerned that police officers in Washington State can kill with impunity because they can't prove malice. Malice is not a provable feeling in your heart or whatever. So, but when the chief of police, Chief Dahl, was on the show, he talked about his concerns, or that there was concerns with the first aid in terms of triage, although he said his attorneys had assured him that that wasn't going to go. But I can see where police departments were like, well, you know, we don't want to prioritize that over getting bad guy or whatever. But in addition to possibly weakening the initiative that Washingtonians got signatures for, that we as a public people have said, we want to weigh in on this, that's where the question comes of, is this constitutional? And God, I don't want to agree with Tim Iman, and I don't. I mean, but if that is true, if they are subverting the balance of power, they're subverting the public's ability to weigh in on an issue for better or worse, what happens if this bill that got passed gets thrown out, but the initiative no longer will go forward? Is that an absolute that the initiative would not go forward?
Yes.
Why?
Because of the way that they did it. That was part of the agreement that they struck. And I agree, it does set a really disturbing precedent that the legislature could say, we don't like the text of this initiative, so we're going to pass it and then modify it and keep it off the ballot. That could be used for some very bad things.
As I had said earlier, we have the Northwest Washington Labor Council President Michelle Stelovich and Community to Community Executive Director Rosa Linda Guillen here in the studio with us. How are you feeling about the abrupt change of I-940?
Well, I mean, I think the I don't want to get into the specifics of 940, but I think it speaks to, especially with the Latino community. I mean, I think that one of the biggest groups in our community that was really concerned and wanted this type of an initiative to pass is the farm worker leaders and the Latino leaders in the Tri-Cities area, where there was a farm worker killed, right? And all sorts of issues happened. That was several years ago. But it speaks to the problem that we as Latino leaders and organizations have in getting our people to vote. Because it, you know, there is so little, there's such a cynicism on the process in getting people to participate in the so-called democratic process that exists. And there was an incredible amount of effort and enthusiasm and hope with this initiative. And if this goes the way, either way it goes, right, it all it does for us on the ground that are talking to people every day, the poor, the disenfranchised, the bruised and the beaten by police, to come back to them, they're gonna say, see, what's left? What's our avenue for justice, right? So I mean, I think it's really disheartening. It's the process that sounds really bad.
And I think you hit on a deep core, which I can't derail the entire show and talk about, but the disillusionment on the left with the system and voting. I mean, it's from the top down. It's from the nation on down. There's so many components, the redistricting components, the voter checklist components, the long lines. And we're so lucky in Washington State, at least, that we have mail-in ballots, that we avoid some of that. And getting back into what the legislature succeeded on this year is that we are automatically registering people to vote, which is huge, but not huge enough if we see a failing and we think that our vote doesn't matter. I mean, I think you and I know, because I've been out ballot chasing when there's been fewer than 50 votes in a race, and it's heartbreaking. But if all you're seeing is, well, wait a minute, the legislature subverted our right to weigh in on a ballot issue, and the legislature was trying to cover up their past or their files because they don't want to be transparent. Yeah, I have to ask, like, is this even, A, is this a system worth fighting for? and B, how do you talk back to that?
So I guess I was thinking about when we saw this is how do we hold them accountable? So if they now, and we elected them, some of them we voted for, but how do we hold them accountable? And how do we show up to make sure? And I keep thinking about that maybe the kids that are out in the streets saying that gun safety is an important, maybe we have to be in the streets. We have to be protesting. We have to show up. Because I don't know of another way to hold them accountable. I mean, we do all kinds of work. We go sit in their offices. We talk about this is important to our communities. So now we need to make sure that they really stand up and they're really doing what they're saying, and that the people of Washington are protected, and law enforcement is trained appropriately, and that somehow we can make sure that people, all people, have fairness. It isn't okay that one group, because of the color of their skin, has the ability to have better, more rights in the law enforcement, or have more fights in the court than people of color. I mean, we have to figure out what is going wrong and how to fix it. I mean, and I don't know if there's a great fix, but I mean, in some ways, we have to do something different because some of it is just not working.
Yeah, and I think that recent history has shown pretty well that non-participation isn't helpful. I get that there's a lot of disillusionment, and you know, I'm a political junkie. I'm reading the stuff all the time. I'm engaged. So, you know, but I don't feel that. But I see a lot of people who are very disillusioned, and when people don't participate, things don't get better. You know, they can't get better. So, I think that you're absolutely right. We need to find the way that speaks to our representatives and lets them know unequivocally what we want. And we see models for that across the country and here in Washington State. Mm-hmm. There are small groups that are tremendously powerful because they are very effective. If you can turn up 40 people at a public event repeatedly, you show an outsized amount of political force.
So it's frustrating. I hope and pray that we have somebody progressive to run for Litton's seat. I would love to see some constituencies represented that are not represented, like the Latino-Latina community. I would love to see people who are strong-voiced and unashamed and unafraid of a system where money talks. And that's what I think is one of the biggest changes. One thing that I love about our state is when the legislature tried to get an exception to the PDC filing to have to share their information, Inslee had the option to veto it. And Inslee got thousands of calls, in a matter of days. That means that people are paying attention. Maybe not everyone, and maybe, you know, maybe there's a whole disillusionment, but the fact that we have people who care enough about transparency is hopeful. Let's get back to the legislative session. Some things failed that made me unhappy, particularly the death penalty failed again, and it seemed like we were closer than we've ever been. What else, Dave?
So one of the big things that our insurance commissioner here in the state has been pushing for a while is a bill to ban so-called balance bills, which are if you have insurance and you go to an in-network facility, but you are seen by an out-of-network provider, you get a gigantic bill in the mail. You didn't know it. You had no way of knowing. And this bill would have, you know, made a system where that could bridge back to your insurance. And this is especially important for, you know, people who are having like a mental health crisis or something where, you know, the facility you go to needs to bring somebody from outside, or they use a testing company that is housed in the facility but not part of the facility like we have here in Whatcom County. So that was disappointing to see that that did not make it very far. It was disappointing that the effort to raise the minimum age for buying certain rifles to 21 was unsuccessful. It felt like there was some momentum this time, and I think they got caught up with other things towards the end of the session. And Florida pulled it off.
I mean, right?
There's a bill that, well, there's two bills that we were watching that one was terribly disappointing, which was the pesticide drift bill that has been presented to the legislature for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years or something like that. And that ended up turning into passing, but as forming another study group.
So what? Tell us what that would have done had it passed.
It would have, it had, what do you call it, notice, you know, warning notices to communities around where they were going to be spraying and all that, kind of, so that the drift didn't go over schools or homes and, you know, workers and things like that. It was, in my opinion, it was a very minor bill. It didn't really do that much for farm workers. We took no position on it because we felt like that's not what, you know, it's not strong enough for farm workers. And it ended up being a study group. So now here we go again. It seems like every year there's a new study group. Oh, and by the way, the U.S. Department, the Washington State Department of Ag gets to choose who the stakeholders are in the study group. And Department of Ag is controlled, of course, by the agricultural industry. So we don't even know if farm workers are going to be part of that. And really, again, if we ask farm workers about it, they're going to go, why? I mean, what... We've said, what more can we say than what we've already said, right? So that was very disappointing to us. But the other thing that was interesting was the passage of a bill recognizing Cesar Chavez as a farm worker leader. Cesar Chavez's birthday is March 31st, and recognizing March 31st as Cesar Chavez Day in the state of Washington. Nothing else. No day off, no nothing. It's just, it's Cesar Chavez Day, right? That took 5 years to pass.
Without, it wouldn't cost,
it doesn't cost anything. It doesn't do anything, nothing, other than basically, in my opinion, it says Cesar Chavez lived. You know, he was a farm worker leader, and we recognize that Cesar Chavez was a farm worker leader in Washington State. I mean, in the United States, and we recognize him in Washington State. It talks about, you know, goes on about educating and schools and all that, but it doesn't provide any. Nothing, no funding, no guidelines, no nothing. And every year, the Republican leadership has just killed that bill. And it's not until this year that we had a very minor majority, right, the bill passed. And I think it's interesting that it's finally out. So we're planning some kind of little celebration on March 31st. We're trying to figure out, you know, what to do. It'll be more direct action type of thing. Doing what actually we think Caesar would have done.
Well, I think it sounds like, not pointing fingers at any specific legislator, that this comes into being one of those issues that people bash because they don't want to recognize immigrant rights, they don't want to recognize farm worker rights, and they conflate Cesar Chavez with, like, recognizing, didn't the same thing happen with MLK? I mean, that they don't want to recognize him because, heaven forbid, that means that they're sensitive to other issues. But for those who are not aware, we could have several shows on Cesar Chavez, but do you want to give a little...
And actually, one of the legislators a couple of years ago, one of the Republican legislators said something like, if this passes, it's gonna start just a domino effect of farm worker strikes all across the state. I mean, it's like, as if that's just magically going to happen. But Cesar Chavez was the founder of the United Farm Workers, the first ever farm worker-led labor union in the country. Still very famous. He's a national hero for all of us. He's my mentor. We organized the way Caesar would organize. And I would be, you know, remiss if I didn't thank Gloria Burton from Catholic Community Services, who fought very hard to get a substantive bill passed. And this was what finally managed to get through. I think that in Whatcom County, we're going to try to honor Caesar the way that we believe Caesar would have wanted to be honored. And he's the last one to think that, you know, this should happen without some kind of benefit for farm workers. So, yeah, I mean, it happened, it passed, and yet do you hear anything about it? There's nothing,
no,
right?
I didn't
this
see
is
any
a
news.
Dead silence about this.
No, well, thank you for being here and being able to share it with people.
And there's so many days, not so many, there's a handful of days like that in Washington State that are state holidays but don't cost anything, nobody gets a day off, nothing like that. You know, the one I've brought up on the show repeatedly is Civil Liberties Remembrance Day, which marks the day the executive order was signed by President Roosevelt to inter the Japanese Americans living on the Pacific coast. And, you know, that was just a few weeks ago, and nobody noticed. So,
and you're listening to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contreras, joined by Dave Willingham, Michelle Stelovich, and Rosalinda Guillen, and we will be back right after this.
The Humanities Washington Board of Trustees is bringing the popular statewide program Think and Drink to Bellingham. Through May, Think and Drink will explore issues such as racial equality with noted scholars and community activists. The series begins at Boundary Bay on March 21st at 7 p.m. with The Long March, Measuring Black American Progress Since 1968, featuring local author and national public speaker Clyde Ford and Vernon Damani Johnson, director of the Monroe Institute for Civic Education. It'll be moderated by Joy Wiggins. The program is free and open to the public. You can learn more at humanities.org.
Women's Spirit Coalition, eliminating violence against Native women and promoting the well-being of Native families and communities. We envision a nation where Native women live safely and where Women's Spirit Coalition is the leader in ending violence against Native women. You can find us on Facebook at Women's Spirit Coalition or online at womensspirit.net.
Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contreras, joined this week with Rosalinda Guillen, Executive Director of Community to Community, Michelle Selovich, Northwest Washington Central Labor Council President, and Dave Willingham. Tim Johnson will be back next week. We are just doing some quick hits on the legislative session. We're going to get more into it next week, but what were some of the good stories, Dave?
Well, we got to talk about the state legislature finally passed a bill that would ban housing discrimination based on source of income. And, you know, as we transition in the west side of Washington State to a zero affordable housing zone, it's increasingly important that we protect, you know, the renters that can still afford to rent here.
So a landlord, more likely property management company, can still ask you to show how much you make, but they can't ask you where you make it. Is that correct?
They can ask you for some sort of proof of income, but they can't specifically deny you if that, you know, comes from, you know, a Section 8 voucher, if that comes from, you know, some sort of work that they don't care for. You know, it's really about, you know, protecting people who aren't necessarily traditionally financially stable.
So I work with people with developmental disabilities, and we know that prior to this law going in, that they were actually evicting people that had Section 8 housing because they wanted to charge higher rents and they wanted to get rid of people with disabilities in their apartments because they had the Section 8, they didn't want to deal with it anymore. So this means that people can stay in their communities, ride the bus so they can go to their job. It was really shocking to me that this was, you know, places that were just down the street from me. This was a landlord, you know, that you knew. And so it's hard. It's hard to look them in the eye and say, well, you're evicting a person with a developmental disability because they don't make enough income so that you can make a little bit more profit off their back or off a person's back. That's just horrible.
Yeah, and none of us win if people who are on Section 8 or have non-traditional income sources can't get housing. You know, that's not a benefit for any of us. That has cost us all dearly in the past, and I hope that things get better moving forward.
And as we've seen with other attempts to regulate discrimination. There are ways around it, and it's not perfect, but it is a hopeful step in a good direction. But not enough. We will get much more into the end of the legislative session next week. I do want to take a quick moment on my own to respond to a letter that Luann Van Werven, she's representative in the 42nd LD, which is most of Bellingham and the rest of Whatcom County. And I want to say this because I don't agree with Representative Van Werven on most issues. I don't agree with any of our representatives in the 42nd on most issues. But representatives like Doug Erickson is kind of unabashed in his disdain for issues that I care strongly about. Vincent Baez will listen and tell you how he feels, pretty straightforward. Luann Van Werven has presented herself as a moderate conservative. So when I saw this email that gave a legislative review where she talked about the Reproductive Parity Act, in which insurance companies, if they offer maternity care, will also offer abortion care, so they're providing choice. She called it an abortion mandate, which sounds like people are being forced to have abortions, and that made me mad. But the other thing that really made me mad is the way that she talked about the conversion therapy bill. The conversion therapy bill in Washington State basically is for LGBTQ teens who are they're identifying themselves as gay or trans, and this conversion therapy is a failed therapy with zero chance of being effective. And basically the bill said that parents cannot force their teens to go. If you're an adult and you want to try conversion therapy, more power to you. I support any adult's ability to do that. This was about children who have one set of values, living with parents who have another set of values, who were forcing them to go through something. And not to personalize this too much, but when I was a teenager, I did try to kill myself because I was in love with a woman and I did not think that there was any hope for me. And this is the problem with taking teens and forcing them into conversion therapy. When she presented that, Luann Van Werven, in her email as an issue that, and I quote, violates the fundamental rights of free speech and religious freedom, it is doing such a disservice to humans. And I just want to call on her, if you're going to be a moderate, then maybe don't use such sloganistic and hateful language. And that's something that I expect from people who toe the Republican Party line.
She shouldn't call herself a moderate, first of all. Why pretend to be a moderate? I mean, I think that needs to stop. That's not moderate at all.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, Doug Erickson, zero love for Doug Erickson, but I know where he stands, and he's not going
right.
to hide it. And Vincent Baez is very honest, but he'll listen to people. Whereas Luann Van Werven, I'm saying, if you're going to use this Republican hateful rhetoric, exactly.
Rosalinda. Because I own up to what I'm being called by the people attacking me. I am a radical feminist. I do believe that farm workers should earn $30 an hour. I do believe that farm workers should not be slaves. I stand by many of the things that I have said so. And I'm not going to, in certain ways, not call myself moderate, but I am intelligent. I'm not stupid, and what I'm saying is the truth. And if that's what she believes, she should say that. And it's not a moderate position. I don't think my position is moderate either.
So, Luann, Representative Van Werven, I guess I would like to hear the truth of what she really believes, because I haven't really seen a vote that isn't exactly what the Republican Party wants. And I question if she's really representing people in the 42nd or not representing everyone. And I'm concerned about her position in human rights and people's ability to make their own choices. And if this is saying her language just represents that you know, why don't they have a freedom to make your own choices, freedom to have your own voice? She's saying, look, this is, I'm pointing to this group of people as that they're not worthy or something. And that's just wrong. And why would you force a therapy onto anybody who doesn't want it? And they're not even, in social work, this isn't even best practice. Come on.
Right, absolutely. You're listening to Cascadia News Now. That is Michelle Stelovich. She is the president of Northwest Washington Central Labor Council, also Rosalinda Guillen. You are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt. Let's transition into talking about the reason that you're both here tonight. So many labor issues right now. Michelle, for those who don't know you, tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got to be the president of the Labor Council.
Okay. I've been involved in a labor union since, I'm trying to think, for quite a long time. It's about the social justice issues. It's about workers' rights. I mean, workers need to have the right to have a voice in their places of work, no matter who the worker is, not just a union worker. And they should always have safety and the ability to come home at every time at night, because too many workers have died in their places of work or have long-term illnesses because of exposure to something. That's not okay. We can do better. We know that many of these substances are harming people. We know that there is good practices. We want fair wages. People should be able to live in the community that they're in.
But who are you?
I am, I try to think about what is that really about. I find myself as, I'm a woman, and I am in a possibly, I'm in a non-traditional position. I'm the third woman that has been the Northwest Washington Central Labor Council president. And I got corrected. I was saying 50 years. And my friend Lori said, oh, no, Michelle, it's 100 years. I'm the third woman. And wow. And I'm concerned, you know. Women have a say in their lives. I mean, and why isn't that we don't have more women leaders stepping up? Labor, there's more women in labor positions and union positions, but they're not the leader. They're not the president. And it's very unusual to find a woman president or even find a woman vice president. So Lynn Dotson is the secretary treasurer, which is in essence the second in command of the Washington State Labor Council. And so there isn't that much leadership. And I bring kind of my humanity and my work with people with disabilities to that. And I care about what my neighbors think. And I care about what happens in my community. And I want people to be able to participate. And so I've been in leadership mainly because I feel that everybody should have a voice. And fair wages and safe working conditions. And so I stand up, said, this isn't right, or this has to be dealt with. And so every time I stood up, somehow I got elected to some position. And now I'm the president, and I'm like, oh, okay, now what? But then I think, I do know, because I know what my values are. My values are that we need to think about people, and we need to think about what is the common good, and we need to care about our environment. We need to care about animals and our water, because these are important and valuable things to everybody, and they're to be shared. We're not going to hoard this particular thing, or this water is only for this person, but it's for all of us, and making sure that our values are there so that everybody has access. And the Hall of Labor is open to everybody. It isn't just about you have a union contract. That doesn't make you excluded. The hall is big and everybody is welcome. And so that's, I think, is the message that I really want people to know, is that that union contract doesn't give you access to the door. It's the fact that you work.
Well, congratulations on being the third woman in 100 years to be president of the Northwest Washington Labor Council. I want to touch on the fact that you said you had a moment of what am I doing here, and that is something that is way too endemic with women in general, mm-hmm. and the fact that both you and Rosalind are such strong women and so seated in yourselves that I believe that you model and can lead the way for so many women who doubt themselves. So thank you to both of you. Now, you're talking about the hall. People don't know what the hall is. People don't even know what the Northwest Washington Labor Council is. So you want to tell us non-union folk?
Sure. I know that I have a tendency to fall into the union jargon. That sometimes is a habit I get into. But the union hall, it's not just a physical place, but it is actually kind of wherever you work too. But the Northwest Washington Central Labor Council represents both public and private unions. So that means that steelworkers, laborers, electricians, social workers, hospital workers, nurses, they're all part of this collective group of union members. And we get together in our local SEND delegates, and we have honorary members that come in that are participating that are from the community. And we work on social justice issues that we care about. And we take stands and we work on those issues, and we help to get people elected that we think will represent our values. And sometimes we call those the lunchbox issues. Yeah.
When you're talking about unions and you're talking about labor, and both have such a history in this country, and I'll be completely freaking honest, my mom taught me Joe Hill, the song Joe Hill, when I was little, and I was steeped in the power of people and the power of unions and why it was so important. Unions have been attacked for years, and I think it's important to bring in, because I think people hear the word union and there's distaste. There are people who believe that unions are not a good thing. We are bringing in our own engineer, Devlin Sweeney. Hi, Devlin.
So aside from being an engineer for this radio station, I'm also an employee for Western Washington, and I fall under a labor class that puts me within the Union of Western Washington. And whenever people talk about union issues, it's interesting because I always think the reality of unions is actually a lot more boring than the reputation associated with unions. But they do serve a lot of features that I do really appreciate as part of being a union. They negotiate my salary on my behalf, so I don't have to sit down with my supervisor every year and have a conversation about what my prevailing wage should be. It's pegged at between 25% and 26% of the median wage mm-hmm. of my class. I don't have to, if I have some sort of grievance with my employer, I don't have to hope that HR represents me and not my employer. I could bring in a union rep at any grievance-associated one. And the thing that I usually appreciate is just there is an active presence of someone representing employees, which I don't think exists in most organizations.
So, Michelle, why don't you tell us, as the president, why are unions still important?
So, I think we're the last kind of group that's not so much the last, but, we are in the sense we are collectively working as a common person, and we're saying that we're going to join together, and we want a better world, and we want a better place to live. And these are the things that we fight for every day, and it's standing up and having that voice in our workplace, and having the right to sit down with management and say, hey, this isn't an issue. This is an issue. We need to work this out together. And being able to have that kind of groundwork, because there's groups that don't have that ability to have a conversation with their management to resolve a conflict or to report a safety issue. One of the great things about a union contract is it protects you from being just fired randomly. So what if you say, this is an issue of safety. If this exposure to that particular chemical will make me sick, and you're going to manage and you can negotiate it, you can say something without being fired.
So let's look at, we have a powerful example, and Rosalinda was very connected with it, what happened with Sukuma Farms, where a union was developed. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, I think that, the whole power of the union is why unions, why corporations and businesses, some businesses have worked so hard to badmouth the power of the union and what the union is. The union is actually a group of workers supporting each other, mutually beneficial to each other and standing together so that it's not just yourself, one person having to deal with the boss without any support. You have the power of all of your coworkers and, the union itself that has resources to protect you and defend you. And you'd think that in most workplaces you wouldn't need this. And I think that's what happened at Sukuma Brothers Berry Farms when they were unable to just fire one worker because then all of the other workers said, no, you fire him, you fire all of us. And then, in essence, Familias Unidas por la Justicia began acting like a union and was a union before the official designation was given to them. And I think that that's the power. It's like if you have an issue, then the company knows that it's not just the one person mm-hmm. they're going to have to deal with, that there's power behind that person that's going to come to their defense.
And it wasn't just about firing one person. It was about the conditions at the farms.
That's
and
right.
And this is the point that ties what all of you are saying together, is that unions came from a horrific situation of horrific conditions. There was the Triangle Fire where
children,
right?
Children working as adults.
Children right. working as adults, but there was a Triangle Fire where women yep. were burned alive. And there's so many things. And I remember, and I know you're much more in tune with what happened at Sukuma, but I remember reading about the conditions that workers were in and the lack of pay that they got for yep. were overwhelming backbreaking labor.
Yeah, for years.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's this ability to stand together shoulder to shoulder. And this is, you know, when you stand, you're just not standing with your own union. You're standing with your fellow union member. So I'm going to stand up. If my friend that's an electrician, if there's an issue there and they say, hey, we need your help. We need you to come stand the line with us at the picket. And we're going to go, yeah, because this is our union brother and our union sister. And we have to stand with them. We know that what we support them, they're going to support us, and us together is stronger.
There's traditions that come with the house, being part of the house of labor. Literally, we consider ourselves brothers and sisters. We take that very seriously. I think that what Michelle is saying is absolutely true about looking to have a better life for yourself and your families into the future. And I think that one of the big missing pieces of why unions are important, because the union is not a thing. A union is a whole bunch of people standing together, calling out, protecting, and calling out injustices. If we all listened to workers more, we'd be protecting the environment. We'd be protecting the rest of the community, because workers are the first ones to know when something is going wrong. With you know, development or production, or you know, stuff being dumped into the ocean, or workers know right away something's wrong here, right? Because they're being harmed, and I think that that's the most important part, is workers are listened to, and that benefits the entire community.
And the reason that this is so important, we're not just in a little kumbaya group right now. The reason that this is so important is because right at this moment, SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, is hearing a case, Janus versus AFSCME, which is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. They're hearing arguments that could permanently handicap the power of public unions. Basically, in a nutshell, Janice is a person who's a child support specialist at the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services. He joins the governor of Illinois, Governor Bruce Rauner. And what they're finding is the payment that you have to pay in order to have unions, the union dues that they represent you in bargaining. There are 22 states, including California and Washington, where you pay a mandatory fee because the union represents you in collective bargaining. It seems like this is coming down to an argument of collective bargaining versus political lobbying.
I would characterize it a little bit different, and I don't like this particular court case. I think that the alternative to it would be worse. But to be fair to what Janice is talking about, I think it comes down to, do I have to? It's a free rider problem versus how do we make this work? So Janice is going, it's a freedom of my speech. I shouldn't be forced to contribute to this union, who will be forced to negotiate on my behalf anyway. So the union's going, well, you're gaining all the benefits of this. You should have to contribute to it. And he's going, well, what if I don't want to be a part of this? And by being an employee of this, I have to be a part of
but
this
But the
union.
Issue has been conflated with political lobbying in terms of speech and representation.
Well, I'm going to really underlying all of this, I think it's really about corporate greed. I think Janice, if you ask me, is really about how do corporations take more from their employees. I don't think it's about just being not having representation. And I know they're trying to strip away workers' ability to complain and to say that there's a problem and to make things better in their workplace and make workers afraid. But it's greed. It's this corporate greed culture that has been happening, and they're just putting incredible pressure. But this specific case, and what you mean by free riders and what people mean by that is saying that, hey, I want to pay nothing and get all the services I want. And negotiations are very difficult. And when you go into a negotiation, you're going to ask for fair wages for your employees so that they can live in their community and have some benefits and make sure their kids can go to school and have a house and live comfortably. That's a big negotiation. And to say, hey, they should have some health care and they should be able to retire in dignity. They're trying to strip away all of their responsibilities of the corporation and make it all on the back of a working person. And we're saying that the person that's the free rider needs to pay their fair share. They need to contribute to, because they're gaining a benefit.
Yeah, and this is the pinnacle of American entitlement culture. You know, this very specific definition of freedom where no one gets to tell me what to do. I'm going to take this job where I know I have to be part of the collective bargaining agreement, but I don't want to have to pay for it. And, you know, it's like just a couple of years ago, there was that young woman who was suing because she was entitled to go to the Texas school of her choice, but somebody else got it. And it's really sad. And yes, I think that, you know, in this case, there's like you were mentioning, Stephanie, they're making the distinction between, you know, you as a member of the collective bargaining unit, you pay dues, but the dues that would go towards political efforts are refunded to you. And the argument that Janice is making is, well, collective bargaining is a political act, and sure, but Janice is not entitled to this position. Janice is not surprised by the fact that this is part of it. This is part of every job listing for any such union job. And it's just baffling to me that people are taking this seriously.
The main issue here for us, for farm workers and when we look at union organizing, that when you get to the point of paying dues, there has been a long process of decision making and participation of every single employee at a company wherever that collective bargaining agreement is in. So everybody in the workplace has had a chance to decide and to vote whether they want collective bargaining or not. And so there is a vote, and then if the majority of the workers say they want a collective bargaining agreement and they want to be represented by a union, whether it's their own union they formed or another, the vote takes place, and there has been a very fair democratic process, which is a microcosm of democracy in America. By the time you get to the negotiations and you negotiate the contract, the democratic process has already happened. It is unfair for the workers that voted against a union, which is usually a very small minority, to then come back and try to subvert a democratic process that has taken place. That's, to me, that is what the most disturbing part of this whole thing. Is that nobody imposed a collective bargaining agreement on anybody. And when the contract is already, if it's already in place and it gets renegotiated, there's another vote for that, right? Workers can vote the union out. It's very simple. There's a process.
You know what's not a democratic process? Corporate consumerism.
Well, also, this isn't unlike other things associated with employment. I can't opt out of my L&I fee that I pay as part of being an employee at Washington State. I can't, if my employer requires that I wear a certain type of shoes or safety equipment, I can't, you know, say, I don't want to pay for that, but I want you still to supply it for me. So it's not unusual to have fees associated with employment or charges. This one, at least, I get services back for it.
So I think that, when we're looking at this case, I think that when I talk about this, they want to make more, they want to silence everyday people, they don't want people to have a voice. And I think that that comes down to that they're actually really trying to undermine kind of what our country was about. I think like the Koch brothers and Freedom Foundation are really anti-American values because one of the values were that we have freedom of speech. And they keep claiming this, but a union contract and a collective bargaining agreement really gives me the most ability to have a voice and to have a voice where I don't have to be afraid of being persecuted, fired. I have a way to make things different, to make things better.
And I'm glad you brought that up about values. You know, especially public sector unions have been at the forefront of things like diversifying our workforce and treating people equally and fairly. I mean, not all of them at the beginning, but over the last 60 years, that has really been a hallmark of specifically public sector unions. And it's something that, you know, we should be proud of. They've really led the way in that.
And, you know, and union members elect to contribute political campaigns. We have a whole separate fund. It's separate from your dues. You can elect to pay it separately. But we get to share with each other about our values for who we want to elect, that is going to care about our wages, working conditions, our environment, and our communities.
Right. Our verdict, Janet's wrong. And
yes.
And voting and representation, good. And we'll see how that develops. But we just have a few more minutes, and I really want to make sure that we focus some on H2A, the guest worker program. And in brief, it is a temporary agricultural program which establishes a way for agricultural employers to anticipate a shortage of domestic workers to bring non-immigrant foreign workers to the U.S. to perform agricultural labor or services of a temporary or seasonal nature. And man, it seems like all kinds of things can go wrong with that definition.
Well, this is so closely, I mean, really, this is so related to Janice and to what's happening. This is like, this is a corporate program, right? And it goes back to exactly the same thing, to having a workforce that cannot speak for itself, that cannot fight, that cannot complain, that has no representation. Janus is about that. It's about taking away the collective power of workers to be able to defend themselves. If you want to go all the way back to the way it used to be in the United States before unions, go to a labor camp at Sarbanan Farms and talk to H2A workers, because that is a captive workforce that is being portrayed as this amazing, you know, workers with this amazing opportunity to earn better wages and that they want to be held captive.
And let's remind listeners, Sarbanan Farms is the Sumas farm where Ernesto Ibarra died last summer. And so,
And I think that's the whole point, right? Mm-hmm. This program here that is in Whatcom County, in our own backyard, is actually, there's over 200,000 or more across the country. It is very prevalent in the East Coast and in the South, very prevalent in the tobacco, sugarcane, all of these, you know, Southern crops that used to be, you know, harvested by slaves. We have a quasi-slave labor program with workers from Mexico. So our concern is that we have an outside corporation from California, Delano, California, that bought 1,500 acres in Whatcom County and is moving towards bringing a quasi-slave labor force into our county, and that is being supported by some very powerful corporate interests outside of our state. And we as an organization and myself personally are being targeted because we are fighting this kind of labor program in Whatcom County. What our organization is about really is about developing a local fair food system that includes the voices of farm workers. This program is going to undermine 15 years of our work in Whatcom County in building coalitions, in educating people on our, from a farm worker perspective, how, what a sustainable food system is supposed to look like, including, I believe, who gets to buy good agricultural land in Whatcom County and how do we protect our local food system. But this program is now pivoting to grow into this huge corporate quasi-slave labor program across the country. And it's interesting how this whole Janus decision, all of this move to undermine workers' voices at every level is happening right now.
Absolutely. And it all plays in different ways into each other. One of the things that struck me, and I did not know about a lot of the ins and outs of the H2A program before last summer, Ernesto Silva Ibarra died. And what happened, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that because he was forced back to work and in awful conditions and not allowed to rest, that he died. He was 28 years old. A bunch of people walked off the job. At that point, Sarbanan said, you no longer work here. But they held the visas. They physically held the visas.
Yes.
So people who had walked off in support, wherever you stand on this, people who were, as you said yourself, his brothers, because
yep.
people who work every day together for hours.
And months
at a time were so stricken that they walked off the job, lost their jobs for this protest. Even if you're super conservative and you agree with that, you cannot agree with a company holding your visas and then preventing you from having a home. They had no way to get back home.
Well, they had no money. They held their paychecks. They said they were going to mail their paychecks home to Mexico. They had no money, no transportation, no visas, and they were walking down the road in the Sumas area. You know, 78 to 100 workers walking down the road with their suitcases. This company just threw them out into the street. And a lot of the workers, the reason they left was because they were concerned of their brother who was sick, but they were having the same symptoms themselves. Literally, some of them were going, we have to leave now or we're going to die. The conditions were so bad with the smoke coming in from the fires in British Columbia. They were so exhausted and dehydrated that the tissue in their legs and feet were literally, it was opening up in frostbite-like conditions from extreme dehydration working there. So, I mean, you know, there's all of these issues happening, and they walked off and they get treated this way. So at that moment, they are completely undocumented workers walking down the road near the Canadian border mm-hmm. in one of the most heavily patrolled area.
Yes, yeah.
You know, I mean, what is that, you know? And they called us. But I also wanted to mention that there's an organization that has popped up called Farmworker Justice Now, and I want to make sure people understand this is an organization that is being paid for by agricultural corporate money, not local money, but yet local agriculture is not speaking out against this, that has taken it upon themselves to contradict all of the facts that we have presented to the community about the death of Ernesto Silva. And this is the newest attack, you know, on trying to have safe working conditions and decent wages and just a fair playing field for farm workers, right?
Yeah, and it's so upsetting every time I hear this, and I hate to cut off our show, but we are live and we have to go. It's very important that you go to community if you want to find out how to get connected. Familias por la Justicia and other organizations as well. But Community is a great umbrella organization that will connect you if you want to find out more or you want to get involved. Huge thanks, Rosalinda Guillen.
Don't believe the Farmworker Justice Now page.
Okay. And huge thanks, Rosalinda Guillen. Huge thanks to Michelle Stelovich and Dave Willingham and Devlin Sweeney for popping in for that conversation, who's also our co-engineer with Nick Crisalia this evening. This is Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham.